Today is December 5th, 2015. Okay, so we can start with homage to the Buddha three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. So today I'm going to try an experiment in covering two suttas in one day. It's the practice of the Pali commentators when they come at the beginning of a commentary, like the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya. I'll spend pages and pages analyzing every word, even the expression evang me sutang, thus have I heard, gets like about 4 or 5 pages of explanation. But then when they come to the end of the commentary, they start rushing through. So I'm following their model. Because we're coming now to getting close to the end of the Majjhima Nikaya. We only have 3 more classes during this semester, but early next semester, that's studying in the spring. Yeah, this week I'll try to take 143 and 147, because there's a little bit of an affinity between them. Then next week, 144 and 145, because at least one helps to illuminate the other. So that will leave just 146, 148, 49, 50, 51, 52. But what do we do when we come to Majjhima Nikaya 152? Anybody know?
We go to a new book.
No. We still have to do Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 1. Oh, she had it. She was raising her finger. Wow, so she's really keeping track of what's going on.
She has been looking forward to number 1.
Yeah, because I left number 1 is very concise and very cryptic. So if you just, I don't know why the compilers put it at the very beginning of the Majjhima Nikaya, because if you open it and try to read it, you just can't figure it out. But after you've gone through the rest of the Majjhima Nikaya, then we could understand it. Or start to understand it. Okay, so now we're taking sutta number 143, and this is the sutta, it's called the Anattapindikovada Sutta, the sutta of the, here it's called advice to Anattapindika, but Ovada is not really advice. I mean, the guy's dying, what kind of advice do you give them? But it's rather, Ovada is more like an exhortation, a kind of like an inspired discourse. Okay, so this tells us, the sutta starts when the Buddha is living at Savatthi in the Jetas Grove, which is also called Anattapindika's Park, because this was, according to the explanation, the commentaries, originally this woods, this kind of woods, had belonged to the prince who was the king, the son of the king of Kosala. His name was Prince Jeta. And Anattapindika, when he gained, he was a resident of Savatthi, and when he learned about the Buddha in Rajagaha, which is quite a distance away, then he invited the Buddha to come to teach in Savatthi. And he wanted to build a monastery for the Buddha. And so he was looking around for a suitable place. And what did he find but a nice piece of land near Carmel, New York? the city of Savatthi. And so he purchased that piece of land from Prince Jeta, and there he built the monastery. And this became what we call the Buddha's main seat of residence. So the Buddha traveled around through most of the year, but during the rains retreat, it was called the Vasa, the rainy season, most or a great number of the rains retreats he spent at Anathapindika's monastery. And so because the Buddha was living there, he forged very close relations with the citizens of Savatthi. So King Pasenadi, the king of the state of Kosala, whose capital was at Savatthi, he became a devoted supporter of the Buddha. And then the Buddha's chief male benefactor or donor was Anathapindika, and also the Buddha's chief female supporter, a laywoman by the name of Visakha. She was also a resident of Savatthi. And so the Buddha had actually two residences at Savatthi. One was Anathapindika's monastery, which I believe was probably to the west of the city. And then the lay devotee Visakha, she set up a residence for the Buddha, which was called the Eastern Park, Pubarama. And so when the Buddha, sometimes he would live in Anathapindika's monastery, sometimes perhaps it was a little more remote, so for more better seclusion, he would go to Visakha's monastery, the Eastern Park. And so because of the Buddha was living much of the time in Savatthi, Anathapindika became very closely associated with the Buddha and developed great devotion to the Buddha. And in fact, under the Buddha's guidance, actually with his first encounter with the Buddha, when the Buddha gave a discourse to him, Anathapindika became a sotapanna, a stream enterer. I don't think there's any account in the canon of Anathapindika going further along the path to the stage of once returner, which seems a little strange, but that's the way it is. Okay, so this sutta, one gets the impression, must be taking place pretty much towards the end of the Buddha's own lifespan, not during his very last days, but now the Buddha would be maybe his late 70s, and Anathapindika is now an elderly man, and so now he's fallen ill. And so this sutta is going to be the discourse given to Anathapindika on his deathbed. Okay, so the sutta tells us that on this occasion, Anathapindika was afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. This is a stock expression used in the suttas whenever anybody gets seriously ill. Most of the time when they are described in this way, they'll recover from their illness. But we'll see this doesn't happen with Anathapindika. Okay, so Anathapindika, when he's very ill, he wants some inspiration and consolation, and so he sends a message to the Buddha. So he addresses, he's a very wealthy man, Anathapindika. He's what is called a sati. That is like a wealthy man who provides finances to the state. And so he has a servant, he sends the servant to the Buddha and says, please go to the Blessed One, pay my respects to him by bowing down at his feet. Tell him that I'm very gravely ill, and then go to the Venerable Sariputta, pay respects to him, give the same message to him, and then ask Venerable Sariputta to come to my residence out of compassion. Anukampam Upadaya. It's a little puzzling. Why doesn't he ask the Buddha himself to come? You know, I don't know the explanation. One might say, oh, the Buddha would have been old, so he didn't want to impose on him. But we see in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse on the Buddha's last days, the Buddha takes a long tour from Rajagaha up to Kusinara, you know, covering several hundred miles. So if he could travel that distance in his very last months of his life, he could have taken the walk from the monastery to Anathapindika's house. Maybe Anathapindika wasn't aware that he was going to die, and so he didn't want to impose on the Buddha. I don't know the answer. Anyway, so he sends the message first to the Buddha, then to Sariputta, and then Sariputta goes to the residence of Anathapindika, and then he asks about his health. Again, this is a standard kind of formulation. I hope you are getting well, householder. I hope you are comfortable. I hope your painful feelings are subsiding and that they are not increasing. But Anathapindika says that this isn't the case. He says, I'm not getting well, I'm not comfortable, my pains are increasing. And then he describes his pains in very vivid terms. He says, it's just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword. So too, violent winds cut through my head. Just as if a man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so there are violent pains in my head. Just as if a skilled butcher were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so violent winds are carving up my belly. And in the Indian physiology of this period to medical analysis, what we would call today we would call them sensations, these would be expressed as winds. Okay, just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals, so there is a violent burning in my body. So if you ever get ill and think you're undergoing a lot of pain, just bear this description in mind. I've done this many times. And then I think I have this chronic head pain condition. But when I read this, I think, I'm just like floating on the air compared to this description. Okay, so now we come to the heart of the sutta, where Sariputta is giving the instructions, the actual instructions, to Anathapindika. And perhaps Sariputta would have used his supernormal knowledge, or even maybe just empirical observation, to realize that Anathapindika is on his way out. And so he's really going to be giving him advice now, or instructions, on how to train the mind as it comes into the death process, so that one has a chance of liberation in that life itself. Okay, so Sariputta says, you should, I'm in paragraph 5 now, then, householder, you should train thus, I will not cling to the I, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the eye. And in the same way, you should train regarding the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. I will not cling to the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the mind. Thus you should train. Okay, so here we have the key phrase which is going to continue through the whole rest of Sariputta's exhortation. You don't mind if I use the Pali customs? Yeah, it's a very simple phrase, but it has very profound implications. So first we have na cakkhum upadhi upadhi sami, which is what is rendered here. I will not, or I shall not, it's like making a mental determination. I shall not cling to the I. And then na me chaku nisitam vijnanam, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the I, will not be supported by the I. Okay, so what we see here is that there's actually a kind of conditional relationship here, that through clinging to, in this case, to any of the sense, the six sense bases, the consciousness comes to rely upon, to be based upon, or to be attached to these six sense bases. And it's when consciousness becomes attached, supported, dependent on any of the six sense bases, that this is what sort of supports consciousness as it makes the transition from one life to the next life. So we can say that there's this clinging, which is like holding to the six sense bases with the ideas, these are mine, this is I, this is myself. Holding to them with craving and with the view of self. So when there's that upadana, that clinging to any of these phenomena, that is providing the kind of fuel that will drive the consciousness on from this life into a new life. Because the consciousness is based upon, through clinging, it's based upon the six sense bases. And through that being based on the six sense bases in this life, through clinging, then the consciousness is going to pick up a new set of six sense bases when one passes from this life. And then that will start the process of the next life, the new life. And actually the word upadana, which is rendered clinging, is the etymology of the word, is provide some insights into what is going on. Yeah, the base of the word adana has the meaning of taking. If you know the second precept in Pali, it's adina dhana viramani, that is abstaining from taking, that's adana, what is not given, adina. So this is taking, and then upa gives a strengthening. A strengthening effect upon the word. So we can render it taking up. And so from upadana is taking up, we get clinging. But the idea of taking up also applies to the way a fire relates to its fuel. So the word upadana is also used to mean the fuel of a fire. And so upadana is the fuel of a fire, and clinging, upadana as clinging, is the fuel that keeps the combustion process of consciousness burning. And when consciousness is losing its fuel in this life, because the body is about to expire, it needs to arise based on some new fuel. And that new fuel will be picking up the set of six sense bases that begins the new life. And so through upadana, through clinging, the consciousness is settled upon, based upon, supported by, dependent on this set of six sense bases. And when, through the expiration of the life faculty, these six sense bases can no longer function as the supports for consciousness, then with upadana driving it, consciousness picks up a new set of six sense bases. And what happens when there is no upadana? Then what is said is that consciousness parinibbayati, which one might render, to make it decent English, it attains nibbana. But if one is going to translate very literally following the Pali, parinibbayati is a verb. So you would say consciousness becomes nibbanized, or it becomes nirvanized. Or sometimes use what's said using the simile of the fire, is that the consciousness, siti bhavati, it becomes cool. Like the fire going out. Okay, so first Sariputta gives this exhortation relating it to the six sense bases, but consciousness can cling to anything in the whole field of experience. So now Sariputta is going to go through different groups of phenomena. So it says, you should train thus, I will not cling to form, sounds. These are the six sense objects. Form, sounds, odors, flavors, tactile objects, mind objects. Then consciousness can cling to consciousness itself. We cling to the experience of things through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. In that case, we're clinging to consciousness. So he's saying, I will not cling to the eye consciousness. And so to ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. And then once you have the six sense objects, the six sense faculties, the six sense objects, the six kinds of consciousness, then their encounter, their coming together, which initiates any particular act of experience, That is contact. So Sariputta continues, I will not cling to eye contact all the ways through mind contact. And then out of contact, there arises feeling or vedana. And vedana or feeling is usually the direct object of craving. And so what we crave is generally pleasant feelings through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, or the peaceful, neutral feelings. And then when we encounter pain through any of the six senses, then we crave to escape that pain by indulging in some kind of pleasure. And so the training here given to Anathapindika, and this is probably most directly relevant to him because he's undergoing these severe pains in his illness, is I will not cling to feeling born of eye contact, etc., born of body contact, born of mind contact. So even when one is experiencing painful feelings, of course one doesn't cling to them with the in the mode of desiring them, but one clings to them when one identifies with the painful feelings and thinks, oh, I have such a headache, oh, such a stomach ache, oh, why does this have to happen to me? Oh, I'm so miserable, I'm undergoing such suffering. So all of these thoughts of I and mine, thoughts of identification that arise from the feelings, these are ways of clinging to them. So he's saying, do not cling to any of these feelings through any of the senses. Okay, then he brings in some other classes of objects. And I suspect that it could be that this was not part of the original discourse, but being added by the compilers just to make the discourse more complete. Though also it could have been, because Sariputta had a very analytical mind, so it could be that he himself actually brought all of these other groups in. So we have, I will not cling to the elements. We have the six elements, the four material elements, the space element, and the consciousness element. Then we come paragraph 11, I will not cling to, here we have the five aggregates from material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Then we come to, this would seem a little strange directed to Anathapindika because from what we can see, he was not an advanced meditator, not an advanced jhanic meditator. And yet here Sariputta is saying, I will not cling to the base of infinite space, I will not cling to the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. These are the four immaterial attainments. So I say it's a bit strange because so far as I can see, I don't know of any sutta passages which speak of Anathapindika as being an attainer of the jhanas. And to reach the formless meditations, one has to go through the four jhanas. And this would be an advice that, like, a monk would give to somebody who was, you know, had this extraordinary ability in samadhi meditation. Because for somebody who gains these formless samadhis, it would be the subtle clinging to them would become the foundation or ground for the consciousness to become established upon them and then to take rebirth in one of those formless realms of existence where the lifespan is thousands of cosmic aeons, but it's not liberation. Okay, then with paragraph 13, Sariputta broadens the scope still further, and he says, I will not cling to this world with the desire to come back to some, you know, to some state of existence in this world. I will not cling to the world beyond, you know, out of desire to be reborn in one of the heavens or any of the divine realms of existence. Then he takes all objects of experience comprehensively and says, I will not cling to what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought after, and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Yeah, in this paragraph, we actually have four. All of the objects of experience are grouped together into four sets. First, we have the seen, which is identical with visible form, the heard, which is identical with sound, the sensed, which is said to comprise everything, the grosser objects of perception, that is, anything smelt, tasted, and touched. In other words, odors, tastes, and tactile objects. And then all the following words are taken to represent objects of a purely mental consciousness. That is, the main word here is cognized, vinyatam, and then the other terms, encountered, sought after, examined by the mind, are just elaborations on cognized. And then my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Thus you should train. So that is Sariputta's ovada, his exhortation, his instruction to Anattapindika. So he's, you know, the purport is that he's advising Anattapindika not to be attached to anything within the subjective and objective domains of experience. And when there is not that attachment, not that clinging, consciousness will not be dependent upon it. When consciousness is not dependent upon it, then with your passing, your consciousness will parinibbāyīsati. It will be nirvanized. It will attain nirvana, go into nirvana, so to speak. Okay, so when Sariputta finishes his exhortation, then Anattapindika starts weeping and he sheds tears. And now Ananda has gone along with Sariputta as his companion. And so when Anattapindika starts weeping, then Venerable Ananda, he thinks, oh, Anattapindika must be feeling miserable. He must be really frightened and agitated that he's going to be dying, and that he's going to be leaving behind all of his loved ones and his possessions. And so he thinks, so he says to Anattapindika, are you foundering, householder, are you sinking? Okay, then Anattapindika says something that seems a bit surprising and also a little bit puzzling, even to me. He says, I'm not foundering, Bhante Ananda. I'm not sinking. But though I have long waited upon the teacher, the Buddha, and the venerable bhikkhus, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma. Okay, then Ananda says 2, and not the Pindika. He says, such a talk on the Dhamma, such Dhamma Katha, is not given to lay people clothed in white. Such talk on the Dhamma is given to those who have gone forth. In other words, to monastics. Okay, this needs a little unpacking or drawing out. Now I say it's a little puzzling because, okay, it's said in the commentaries that when the Buddha is giving many of these like profound discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya, Saṅyutta Nikaya, though he says, oh bhikkhus, like he's addressing monks, but the commentaries say that actually the fourfold assembly is present, so that there will be bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasakas, male lay followers, and upasika, women lay followers. So from this we can see that lay people will also be listening to these discourses. But what I could see is that when Anattapindika comes to the Buddha for a personal discourse, the Buddha always speaks to him about, from the standpoint of the Dhamma, about how to conduct one's affairs as a householder. Like, what is the proper use of wealth? How is a lay person happy in the household life? How does one take care of one's wife and children? Occasionally he'll speak about how a householder should go off in seclusion and reflect on the virtues of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, on the virtues that reflect on his own practice of morality, generosity. You know, but I'm not aware of discourses and where the Buddha is speaking one-on-one, so to speak, to Anattapindika, where he says, don't be attached to anything seen, heard, sensed, cognized. And the reason, perhaps, is that Anattapindika was generally a very wealthy householder, a large household with a lot of affairs to take care of. He is reputed to have been, as I said earlier, what's called in India a sati or shreshti, one with a lot of wealth, almost like the treasurer, the state, but not the actual treasurer, but like a banker, okay. A banker, one with a lot of wealth who provides sponsorship to the king so that the king can conduct the affairs of state. You know, the unholy alliance of the politicians and financial institutions. But Anattapindika, of course, was a man of upright conduct. And so, for this reason, I think when the Buddha or the venerable monks are speaking to Anattapindika, they don't speak to him, they don't give him these high, profound discourses. And there were some householders, though, who had very, very deep and very astute knowledge of the Dhamma, and apparently high attainments in meditation, especially the one who's mentioned as outstanding in that respect is one called Citta, the householder, who has a whole chapter to himself in the Samyutta Nikaya. I think it's chapter 41. And Citta would sometimes invite the monks to come for an alms offering, and then he would give them, you know, coming, like playing the role of a simple householder, and he would give them a question, Bhante, what is the meaning of this? How do you explain that? And sometimes the monks would all be stumped by his question. And then since Citta has to take on a humble role, according to the monks, he would say, well, the way I understand it, it's this way. And actually, he's actually referring in his explanation back to a discourse by the Buddha. And then the monks would say, sadhu, sadhu, householder, you have such a clear and deep understanding of the Dhamma. You know, so I don't think this should be taken as a generalization. Though Anatta Pindika is probably just explaining on the basis of his own experience. But Ananda's answer still has to be taken in the sense that, again, it needs a little interpretation, that probably what he means is that on an individual basis, this type of discourse is not given to householders in white, because they are concerned with, you know, with all of the travails, the day-to-day difficulties of managing their household life. But if they come in the evening to hear the evening discourse that the Buddha is giving to the monks, then they will get to listen, to hear such discourses. Okay, but then Anatta Pindika makes this great plea to Sariputta. He says, please, Bhante Sariputta, let such Dhamma talks be given to lay people clothed in white. And clothed in white, I should mention, because in the Asian countries, in India during the Buddha's time, in Sri Lanka today, when lay people, devout lay people, go to the monastery, they wear white. I think maybe because of the commercially produced clothing, that tradition is sort of fading out. But in the earlier eras, earlier times, they would always wear white, particularly when they are undertaking the special precepts, then they wear the white clothing. Okay, so Anatta Pindika continues, please let such talks be given to the lay people clothed in white. There are clansmen, I should say clans people, there are people with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away, fading away through not hearing such talk on the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. And what's interesting is, has anybody encountered those exact words before in a different context?
I think it's Sahapani, when he went to the Buddha and pleaded to...
Exactly. If you remember, if you go back to Sutta number 26, in the, you know, don't look at it now. I'm just referring to it. If you look at Sutta number 26 in the Majjhima Nikaya, when after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he's sitting on the seat of near the Bodhi tree, and then he's pondering, should I teach the Dhamma to the world or not? And then it said he looks out at the world and he sees people are just so wrapped up in greed, hatred, and delusion. If I were to teach the Dhamma, nobody would be interested. They're all, you know, looking at their little phones, all glued to their iPhones or iPads. Do they call them tablets? And here, abandon greed, hatred, and delusion. Wait a moment, Bhante, there's some interesting movie on. Or in this country, addicted to their guns. And so, you know, Buddha thinks if I try to teach the Dhamma, they're not going to be interested. It's just going to be trouble for me, and it's not going to do any good for the others. Okay, so when the Buddha has this thought, then a Brahma, a high divinity named Sahampati, he sort of vanishes from the celestial realm. He comes and appears in front of the Buddha and he says, please, Bhante, don't think in that way. Look out at the world. There are some with little dust in their eyes who are fading away through not hearing the Dhamma, they will be able to understand. And then the Buddha, when he hears that request, then he looks out again with his super Buddha vision upon the world, and then he sees that there are indeed people who can understand, and then he decides to teach. Okay, so that is Anatta Pindika's great request, or maybe his last words, to Sariputta. Okay, then, after this discussion, Sariputta and Ananda leave Anatta Pindika's house, they go back to the monastery, and soon afterwards, Anatta Pindika passes away. Even though he might have been trying to meditate according to Sariputta's instructions, he didn't reach the goal. So his consciousness was not yet parinibbayati, was not yet nirvanized. And so he passed away, and he was reborn in the Tusita heaven. The Tusita heaven is 1, 2, 3, the fourth level of the six sense-sphere heavenly realms. And that is said to be the abode where the Bodhisattva Maitreya is now dwelling. And from there, when Gautama Buddha's teaching disappears, then at some time in the future, Maitreya Bodhisattva will descend from the Tusita heaven and come into the human realm and then become a Buddha. Okay, so Anatta Pindika is reborn in the Tusita heaven, and then it's said that in the commentary it said that after he was reborn there and he sees his heavenly good fortune, and he ponders, how did I get to arise here? How did I achieve such good fortune? And when he ponders on that question, then he sees that, this all happened because of the merits that I accumulated as a supporter, a benefactor of the Buddha and the Sangha. And so then he thinks, let me come down and pay them a visit to express my appreciation. And so, of course, he doesn't come down like a human being, or he doesn't come in the middle of the day, but it's the practice that devas come to the Buddha, usually in the dead of the night when everybody else is sleeping and everything is quieted down. I think this would have happened much more often back in ancient times when the world was very quiet and relatively... I don't think the world was ever peaceful. I mean, there were wars going on all the time. But we didn't have all of this electronic gadgetry, which I think creates, my opinion, this is not from the Pali commentary, creates a kind of a vibrational field which is repulsive to the deities. And maybe it interferes with their own vibrational frequencies. And so they don't come down here to visit so often. But in ancient times, when we didn't have all of this, these kinds of powerful forms of energy, like electricity, this whole, and all of these communications, lines of communication, electronic communication, and these, polluting the world with all of these substances that we're burning, creating so much dirt and pollution, then the deities want to keep away, keep a distance. But in earlier times, there would have been much easier communication between the divine realms and the human realm. So that's why we have like scriptures from the great religious traditions which speak about frequent encounters between the human and the divine. Okay, so here Anatta Pindika comes to the Buddha in the middle of the night, and he recites some verses expressing his first his appreciation of the Jetas Grove, which he himself had donated to the Buddha, and then giving some instruction on how to live the wholesome life, and then praising Sariputta. So he says, "Oh, blessed is this Jetas Grove, dwelt in by the sagely Sangha, wherein resides the king of the Dhamma, the Dhamma Raja, the Buddha, the fount of all my happiness." So that's praise of the grove, the Sangha, and the Buddha. Then he speaks like words of advice to the world. By action, knowledge, and Dhamma, by virtue and a noble way of life, by these are mortals purified, not by lineage or wealth. Therefore, a wise person who sees what truly leads to his own good, should investigate the Dhamma. Maybe that's significant coming from Anathapindika, who is not known to be an investigator of the Dhamma, and purify himself with it. And then he praises Sariputta. Sariputta has reached the peak in virtue, peace, and the ways of wisdom. Any monk who has gone beyond at best can only equal him. Okay, so Anathapindika recites these verses. The teacher, probably by silence, approves of them. Or maybe he actually spoke approving them. And then Anathapindika vanished. Okay, then the next day, the Buddha addresses the monks and he tells them that he's sort of testing them, and he says, in the middle of the night, a young god of beautiful appearance came to me, illuminating this whole Jetas Grove. And after saluting me, then he recited these verses. Then he repeats the verses. And then he vanished. Okay, when he says this, then the Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, he says, surely, Bhante, that young deity must have been Anathapindika, for the householder Anathapindika had perfect or full confidence in the Venerable Sariputta. Okay, then what the Buddha says is interesting. He says, first he applauds Ananda, he says, good, good, Ananda. Then he says, the Pali goes, yava takam takaya patabam anupatam tam taya, which means, very literally, as far as it might be reached by thinking, that by you has been reached. So that is a very literal rendering. Well, that by you, you have arrived at that. So that's what's translated here. As far as reasoning goes, you have drawn the right conclusion. Because, and then the Buddha says, that young god indeed was Anathapindika, no one else. Okay, the reason why the Buddha says this to Ananda is that Ananda is going by inference. He's drawing from the fact, probably first, that the deity praised Jetas Grove, and then he praised Sariputta. And so he thought that since Anathapindika has just died and our deity has appeared and praised the grove and the Sariputta, that must be Anathapindika. But the Buddha doesn't have to yavatakam takaya patam. He doesn't have to go by thought, by reasoning. The Buddha himself knows directly that that was Anathapindika. Okay, and that is the discourse. Maybe we can take any questions that come up. Okay, Richard has, you can pass the microphone down to Richard.
There's two buttons on the mind. The lower one you want to push up, the upper one you want to push to the right, and it will be on.
Okay. Another pointer card is a Sati. Is it S-A-T-I?
No. In Pali it's Sati.
Sati.
In Sanskrit it's Shreshti. Which, it's a term that indicates a very wealthy person who provides finances. I think his role, probably they started out originally, I think this is the speculation, as gold merchants.
Yeah.
And then through dealing in gold, they accumulated a lot of wealth. And then they took on the role of providing wealth to the king.
Right.
With the assumption that the king will eventually pay them back.
But he would have been a Vaishya, right?
Probably he was from the Vaishya clan.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the thing that I'm wondering about is that he was an upright man.
Yeah.
So I assume that means that he wasn't violating any of the precepts.
Yeah.
So you got the precept of right livelihood.
Yeah.
And you got the precept of non-killing.
Yeah.
Right. Meanwhile, when he's supporting the state, I mean, he's basically a taxpayer, but at that time it was like not more than 1% of the population that did that, right? So when he's supporting the state, he is the assumption that he's not thereby supporting killing, and when he's making his money by trading in gold and such, the assumption is that's right livelihood.
Yeah, first I'll take the second part.
Okay.
I'm assuming that gold would have been used as a medium of exchange.
Yeah.
And so this would be an essential medium of exchange. Yeah.
Well,
so I don't see that it's a wrong life.
No, I suspect that at the time, gold was used by relatively few people. It was the rich who had gold.
Yeah.
Other people would have had the same kind of problem that's described in the Bible in Jerusalem, where, for instance, people were obligated to pay their taxes in Roman currency, which they didn't have.
Yeah.
And so the first thing, I mean, that's why the money changers tables were in the temple, right? So first thing they had to do was to go and exchange something to get the money to get, to be able to pay.
Yeah.
And I assume that's the status that gold would also have had.
Yeah.
So that it was an instrument of oppression, because the conversion rates for the gold and so on could be very easily manipulated. Yeah. And so people probably felt that dealing in gold was quite oppressive and exhausting to them, as for a farmer, for instance. So I'm wondering, does participation in that kind of system, that's not a violation of a precept?
Yeah, first, I mean, I don't know the details of Natha Pindika's way of... the details of his livelihood. It's just that in the commentaries he's described as a Sati.
Yeah.
And what I've read is that the Sati class had the function of... It arose from the... Probably from the goldsmiths who were making ornaments, and then when gold came to be used, it became the medium of exchange.
Yeah.
And so the Satis were the class that had gold, and then they would provide gold to the king.
Yeah.
They would provide gold to the king to conduct the affairs of state. Pasenadi was also a disciple of the Buddha. There are accounts of him engaging in a defensive war. I don't know the details of.
I could
just trust that Anatta Pindika, as a noble disciple, would not have himself been directly responsible for killing and oppressing others.
Directly.
Yeah.
But then the way the precepts are written, for instance, I won't approve of, won't support, so seems to include indirectly too. And so what I'm trying to discover is what's the index of indirectness that's crucial here. And I understand that you know, it's quite plausible in his personal relationship, he's a very decent man. Okay? My question is about what his impact on other people through these indirect relationships.
This I don't, you know, I don't know the details. But one thing I should mention about Anathapindika, first, Anathapindika was not his actual proper name, but it was a sobriquet, the designation given to him. And it means, Anatha means the helpless, especially orphans and widows and poor people.
Yeah.
And Pinda means originally a lump, and it has the implication of giving food. So Anathapindika was one who gave food and other provisions to, you know, to the orphans, widows, and the poor.
Well, is that kind of the equivalent in Buddhist? Is that kind of the Buddhist equivalent of, say, seeking indulgences in medieval Christianity?
No, not at all. No, it said that he was a very compassionate man and did this out of compassion. Okay, any other questions? Way in the back, Suki.
When Anathapindika called for Sariputta, the purpose of calling, I thought, was really to ease the pain. That was what I thought, because he was in such a terrible pain.
Yeah.
But actually, when Sariputta came, his Dhamma talk was like really preparation of a dying. So, did he give any? I mean, it's that Dhamma talk also is just for easing the pain, or that he didn't really care? I mean, that was not the purpose of Sariputta.
By easing the pain, that would be the job for a physician. You mean to console?
Right.
To console and uplift?
Yeah, so. No one can console.
I think, you know, we don't know so much of the details of the background. You know, whether Anathapindika thought that he was on the verge of death or just thought he was seriously ill and needed some inspiration, that I don't know. But it seems that Sariputta must have sized up the situation, and realized that Anathapindika didn't have much time left. And so his discourse, Sariputta's advice, or his exhortation, to, the way I understand it, was based on the understanding that that Anathapindika is about to pass away.
So that was the Dhamma talk on preparing for the death?
I think that was Sariputta's intention.
Right.
Yeah.
Then the Sariputta said, you should train thus, or those. I'm not really uncertain there. How, that's like you thinking, I will not do this, I will not attach on this, those are all thinking. Now that's it. How, is there any other training that he has to do it in any other sutta that is shown? It's just the thinking there.
Well, it becomes more than thinking, but it becomes a way of training the mind when excuse me, when these thoughts of clinging to this, you know, the sense bases, the sense objects, the feelings, when those thoughts of clinging arise, then he's being trained to dispel those thoughts. And probably, you know, we don't have the full discourse, but maybe Sariputta also said you should train by contemplating all of these things as being netam mama, neso vamasmi, nameso ata, This is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. And so even though he is lying down, and though he's very weak because of the illness, but he could still direct his mind to contemplate in that way.
And isn't there another sutta also which apparently Anathapindika and Sariputta's relationship goes way back, and there is some prior commitment in Sariputta's mind that when this gentleman is going to pass away, he's going to be there for the transmission. I don't know.
That I don't remember, but there is another sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. This is the Sotapatti Samyutta, the collected discourses on stream entry, where Anathapindika is very ill.
Right.
And I think it's Sariputta that he sends for.
That's right. Right.
It could be Sariputta or Ananda. I have to look at it again. And on that occasion, apparently, they could see that the illness was not as severe as in this case. So the monk who was speaking, whether Ananda or Sariputta, then reminded Anathapindika that he was a stream enterer, that he possessed the factors of stream entry, and so that he could rejoice in that.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I just have a couple of questions.
Okay.
One of them is kind of a follow-up to what Suki was asking. Would it be correct to say that the term clinging could be defined as self-identification?
Right? I'd say self-identification is one aspect. And there's self-identification and also what I would call taking possession of or claiming possession of.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think... So when you say, I will not cling, it's kind of like, you still have like that I...
No, this is just a verb of ordinary usage.
Oh, okay. All right.
In fact, even the way it's expressed, it even doesn't use in Pali, it's the pronoun isn't necessary. So when you have the verb upadi sami, it's just the first person verb. So the I is implicit in it, but
it's not.
Okay. Yeah.
And then my other question was, do you know the reason why lay people chose white as a color?
I think it indicates, it's just that it indicates purity, because they're observing the precepts of purity.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, I want to go on now, because I said we were going to do two suttas. So let us do the advice to Rahula, which is also a very short sutta. And you can see Rahula is a pabajita. He's one who's gone forth. He's a monk. So this is... But he's not dying. He's not dying here. But this is the Buddha's instruction to Rahula. And Rahula was, as you probably all know, is the Buddha's biological son. So according to the traditional life of the Buddha, this much, I think, may be part of the legend rather than fact, but it said that on the very day that the Buddha decided to renounce the household life and become an ascetic, his wife, Yasodhara, gave birth to a baby boy, and when they had to decide on a name, the Buddha chose the name Rahula because it said that the word Rahula means a fetter, because it's already he was married, so the wife was one fetter. And now, when he's just about to launch out in his great escapade, his quest for freedom, a little boy is born, and that's sort of binding him down, another thing, binding him down to the household life. So he says, the appropriate name is Rahula, a fetter. Okay, but after the Buddha reached enlightenment, when he came back to visit his native city of Kapalabhattu, at that time Rahula was 7 years old, and so his mother points out the Buddha to him and says, you see that ascetic? That is your father. Go ask him for your inheritance. And so Rahula comes to the Buddha, 7-year-old boy, and says, please, Father, give me my inheritance. And then the Buddha thinks, if I were to give him, you know, the family wealth, all of the, because he came from an aristocratic family, the gold and silver and properties, all of those things would just fade in time and perhaps even become a cause of bondage and unwholesome activity. Let me give him a truly world-transcending inheritance. And so then the Buddha turns to Sariputta and says, ordain the boy. And so at the age of 7, Rahula becomes a novice monk. And then the Buddha gives 3 discourses, or at least there were 3 in the middle-length discourses, addressed to Rahula. One of them apparently was given when Rahula was just still a very young boy, and this is Sutta number 61, which is basically the theme is not to speak falsely, because perhaps Rahula as a little boy, a mischievous boy, would maybe exaggerate things and speak falsely to others. So the basic theme is not to speak falsely, and before doing any deed of body, speech, and mind, to reflect on what one is doing and not do anything that's harmful to oneself, harmful to others. Okay, then when there's a discourse, number 62, which was given when Rahula, we could conjecture, according to the commentary, was now probably in his adolescence, you know, 17, 16, 17, 18 years old. I think the commentary says he was 18 years old. So it was, we could even say, a young man coming from royal family. He would have been, had very physically, he might have been very handsome, strong. And so he was attached, or at least he had the disposition to attachment to this body and pride, what's called the kshatriya pride. And so the Buddha gave him advice on contemplating the body in terms of the elements and breaking the identification with the body. So that would have been appropriate to him. And then going on to give him instruction in mindfulness of breathing as a meditation object. And now we come to this discourse where the Buddha is going to give him the instruction that leads him to arhatship, to the final goal. And so the sutta starts when the Buddha is alone in meditation, and then he thinks, I don't like this word deliverance, but I prefer it's vimukti, which is liberation. The states that ripen in liberation have ripened in Rahula. Suppose I were to lead him on further to the destruction of the asavas, the destruction of the defilements. So what are these states that ripen in deliverance, ripen in liberation? So according to the commentary mentions the 5 spiritual faculties, that is faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So through the years, Rahula must have been training himself based on the instruction that the Buddha gave in the earlier sutta on contemplating the body as being not self by way of the elements, through mindfulness of breathing. And in this way, he would have developed his practicing vigorously, he's developing energy, doing all of this with mindfulness, so he's strengthening his mindfulness. As his mindfulness strengthens, he develops samadhi, and then he's been contemplating the 3 characteristics: impermanence, dukkha, non-self, in the body and the other the other aggregates. Okay, so this is the commentarial explanation. But I found that there's another sutta that uses this expression, the states or factors that ripen liberation. This is called the Meghya Sutta, which occurs in the Udana as sutta number, wow, I didn't write it down. It's sutta number 31 in the Udana. And it also occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, book of nines. I think it's sutta number 2 in the book of nines. So here the Buddha mentions 5 things. He says there are these 5 things that ripen in liberation. When the mind is not yet ripened for liberation, these are the 5 things that ripen in liberation. So the 5 things he mentions there, the first is good friendship, associating with good, worthy friends, spiritual friends. Then the second is sila, that is observing proper moral discipline or moral conduct. Then comes having the chance to listen to uplifting Dhamma talks, talks that open the mind and inspire the mind. Then comes energy, striving vigorously to abandon unwholesome mental states and develop wholesome mental states. And then comes punya, wisdom or insight into the arising and passing away of things. Okay, so then the Buddha says that when based upon these 5 things, then one develops 4 things further. And these are the 4 meditation objects. So the Buddha here says one develops the perception of the unattractive nature of the body as the antidote to sensual lust. One develops metta, loving kindness, as the antidote to ill will. One develops mindfulness of breathing in order to abandon distracting thoughts. And then one develops the perception of impermanence in order to arouse or generate the perception of non-self. Okay, so these are another set. Actually, the two are not completely different. We have the 5 spiritual faculties, which include energy and wisdom. Well, and then we have the 5 factors mentioned in the Meghya Sutta and the 4 meditation objects, which lead to samadhi and to insight. So the two sets overlap. So Rahula must have been developing these factors over the years, and now they're all mature. His mind is right at that point. Just, you know, all the accumulations or all of the contributing factors have been accumulated. He just needs a discourse from the Buddha to trigger off the final realization. And so now the Buddha calls him, and they want to go off to have a private talk. And then it said, on that occasion, many thousands of deities followed the Buddha, thinking, today the Blessed One will lead the Venerable Rahula to the destruction of the asavas. And according to the commentary, these deities had previously, in a past life, had been companions of Rahula when Rahula made his first determination, in the future I want to become the personal son of a Buddha. Then those thousands of his friends were present. Well, having thousands of friends seems an exaggeration. But that's what the commentary says. And so they were present and they rejoiced in his aspiration. And then through their own merits, they had been reborn in the celestial realms. And now they must have been able to know what is taking place in the human realm and realize that Rahula is about to make, to achieve the final realization. And so they all gather to hear this discourse. Okay, so then the Buddha gives Rahula a discourse basically on the three characteristics applied to the six sense bases. So the eye, and we've gone over this before and we'll come to it again, so I'm not going, and the time is very limited, so I'm not going to explain the principles in detail, but we have the eye, ear, nose, etc., are all impermanent, dukkha, and non-self. And then the Buddha goes through the six sense objects, the six types of consciousness, six types of contact, six types of feeling. So you see, this is reproducing the same content that we found in the discourse to Anattapindika. And so all of them are impermanent, dukkha, non-self. And then in paragraph, what's given here is 4-8, the Buddha also brings in, since the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, as well as their objects are material objects, so that represents the form aggregate. Now, and then the Buddha has spoken about consciousness as well, but, well, here he brings in the mental factors that arise through contact associated with feeling. He says, is anything comprised within the feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness that arise with mind contact as condition, is that permanent or impermanent? Then he goes through the three characteristics. Okay, so now in those paragraphs, the Buddha is giving, we call, the basic groundwork or material for the development of insight wisdom, seeing all the factors of experience as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self. Then comes the consequence of that insight. Seeing thus, the noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye forms, eye consciousness, and so on. So we have here disenchantment, a kind of inner disillusionment with them and turning away from them. Then he becomes disenchanted with all of these other groups of objects. Then there, in my edition, the paragraph was missing. Somehow it dropped out. I don't know which edition you have, but let's see if it's there. It should go, when he becomes disenchanted, then he becomes dispassionate. When he becomes dispassionate, his mind is liberated. And when his mind is liberated, then there comes the knowledge. It's liberated. And he understands birth is finished. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. Now there is no more coming back to this. You have that in your edition? Okay, so mine is an older edition. Okay, so that is what the Blessed One said. And then it's, the text continues that the Venerable Rahula was satisfied and he rejoiced in the Buddha's words. And while the discourse was being spoken, then through not clinging, you see, the end of upadana, the Venerable Rahula's mind was liberated from the asavas, from the taints. And in those many thousands of deities, there arose the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Okay, that formula means that these deities, they didn't become, with regard to Rahula, the mind liberated from the asavas, that means he achieved arahatship, the final stage of the path. But in the case of these many thousands of deities, they gain the direct insight realization of the Dhamma, which means they don't be, at this point, they don't become arahats, but they become either stream enterers, once returners, maybe in some cases non-returners, the lower three stages. Okay, that's a pretty quick run through of the Rahula Sutta. Okay, I think we have to go up for the meal now, but we'll come back and then we can take up any further questions or comments, points for discussion. Let's do it a little, because you have to walk down. 12:30, we'll be back here. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, I'll just recite the verses. By now you should memorize them. Okay, so we share the merit with the thousands of devas and the buddhas, the yakshas, the dragon spirits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Oh, I'm sorry. It should be speaking about memorization. Chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu mam param. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya avichihetato etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, now we end with 3 half-hours, the Buddha. One.